going to pass straight on to Helen, and then perhaps you can... You can ask questions after for both of us. I'm delighted that three, as I said, four more expert colleagues are coming to talk now. And the first of those is Helen Pearson, who's curator of Chinese textiles and dress at the V&A, a great enthusiast of shoes and always has wonderful ones on. So, and she's going to talk a bit about the V&A and BM collections and clothing and shoes, I hope. So thank you, Helen.
Right. PowerPoint. Oh. Dun, dun, dun. Yay. Oh, interesting. Okay.
Helen, use the mouse and do the thing towards you, the trackpad towards you.
Right. Okay. Anyway. Right. Thank you. Archaeological finds suggest that silk production originated in mainland China during the Neolithic era, some 6,000 to 7,000 years ago. Many of the early finds are silkworm designs on pots, inscriptions on oracle bones, and bronzes with imprints on silk fabrics. And the earliest silk fragments so far were excavated from two earthenware coffins in Henan province in the 1980s, dated to circa 3,500 BCE, and you can kind of see it. Can I do that? Yeah, the top one. So the best type of silk is obtained from the cocoons of the larvae. Is it very slow?
Do you use the mouse?
Mouse.
And pull it towards you, not the tracker on
top? Nope.
Yeah.
Okay. The best type of silk is obtained from the cocoons of the larvae of the mulberry silkworm Bombyx mori, which is reared in captivity called sericulture. This silk is strong, continuous filament, and unlike the short-fibred wool, cotton, and wild, uncultivated silk, it does not need to be spun to form a workable yarn. The shimmering appearance of silk is due to its triangular, prism-like structures of the silk fibre, and in unspun form allows it to refract the incoming light at different angles, and that's why you get this shimmering, lovely appearance. So knowledge of the silkworm cycle was critical for the sericultural development. Although its lifespan is brief, only 40 to 60 days, the silkworm passes through four completely different stages, as you can see here on the screen. And the caterpillars sustain themselves with mulberry leaves for 25 to 30 days when they begin to emit silk and build a cocoon. So once a silkworm creates about 800 to 1,000 meters of silk during maturation, and after about 15 days, the moth emerges out of the cocoon. So the whole process demands control of a perfect environment for eggs and worms, not too damp, not too cold, not too warm, and providing fresh mulberry leaves every day, and then ensure that the chrysalis will not transform into a moth and break the threads. So this work seems traditionally been done by women, as it kind of is a bit like rearing little babies, actually. And about 1,500 BCE, royal households note as well that female overseers managing sericulture and rituals relating to sericulture started. It was most likely a very exclusive craft practiced within a very limited area to begin with. Production was reserved for the court and the most privileged members of society. It requires about 600 silkworms to produce 1.7 square meters of silk cloth. So there is a lot of worming going on and a lot of taking care of. It is possible that women were also doing the weaving at this early date. However, by the first millennium BCE, specialized weaving workshops emerged, and these are most likely to have been occupied by men, in contrast to women in household production. Silk production was a state-guarded secret, but such a desirable commodity, and a very expensive one, was soon taken up by other cultures. And like ripples on water, sericulture spread around China, and the practice had been established in the Byzantine Empire during the 5th century. In central China, the most important early finds date to the Warring States period and were excavated from the Shu tomb in Mashan, Hebei, dated to about 4th century BCE. The female inhabitant was accompanied by numerous clothes and bedding, woven and embroidered, and the weaves found were plain weave, open weave gauze, patterned plain weave, and complex gauzes, all showing at this stage quite fairly advanced weaves. There was also some wonderfully expressive chain stitch silk embroideries in once beautiful colours. However, Chinese embroideries from the same date has also been found as far away as Pasirik in Siberia. The first serious links with the Western world were forged under the expansive Han Dynasty. And due to the dry climate, a great quantity, as we know, of textiles from Han to Tang Dynasty were found in important sites along the Silk Road, as we've seen this map before. And the East Asian section at the V&A Museum is acting as a custodian for nearly 600 textile fragments and circa 70 other materials, such as terracotta, ceramics, and Buddhist art objects, all recovered from the abandoned oasis settlements along the Silk Route by the Hungarian-born Sir Mark Oriel Stein. So these were brought back from three long expeditions between 1900 and 1916 into the Tarim Basin in China's west, as Susan talked about earlier. This is northwest China, today northwest China, the Uyghur autonomous region of Xinjiang, and also the Gansu province. The material Stein recovered from these expeditions is today divided between four institutions: the Victoria and Albert Museum, the British Museum, and the British Library, all in London, of course, and then the National Museum in New Delhi, India. But apparently there are a few pieces in Kolkata as well. The Victoria and Albert Museum did not contribute financially to any of Stein's expeditions, but recognised the importance of the finds and were given on permanent loan by the government of India in three instalments. Most of these in the V&A collection were recovered in the second expedition, but also some from the third. These significant textiles, dating from about 200 BCE to 1200 CE, comprises a wide variety of different techniques and materials, and embraces examples of domestic textiles to sacral silks. The majority of the collections do come from Cave 17 of the Mago Grottoes near the oasis town of Dunhuang, as also Susan Whitfield talked about, and the lovely cave. I love that picture with Paul Elliott in it. Well, in this talk, I'm going to focus, present or give out ideas, rather, what people in this area in northwest China might have been wearing in the first millennium based on the fragments in the Stein collection. And it appears to have been very little silk. The majority of the V&A Stein textile collections consist of wool and hemp fragments. And that is, I am excluding then the Buddhist silk objects from Dunhuang. So there is wool in different weaves. We even got pieces of fur coats and hemp in different ways. So although China was or is the land of silk, and that silk in large quantities were transported through the Tarim Basin along the silk routes, silk was expensive, and in particular patterned silk, and perhaps also a little contradictory, probably was not so easily sourced for the average person living in one of these oasis towns. So wool and hemp were most likely the main materials for the wardrobe of the people living around the Taklamakan Desert. For example, strong and warm shoes were needed for the desert life and travel in the winter. And several shoes were recovered from sites known as the Lemus Watchtowers, which actually include several different sites of fortified encampments north of Dunhuang, along the edges of the desert. So it's kind of following on to the Great Wall. And these fortified encampments were designed to ensure the safe transit of goods, of course, across the area, and served also as a base for Chinese expansion into Central Asia. And within the towers, Stein found an astonishing range of artifacts, which provide a glimpse of garrison life and military operations under the Han Empire, including bronze mirrors, coarse pottery, tools, leather armor, weapons, and of course clothing. Ancient documents included also personal letters on silk and wood, and military directives, and also supply lists. So this peculiar looking shoe, which actually is my favorite, was discovered in a refuse heap, probably discarded most likely because of its worn holes in the heel and a ball of toes. So although the shoe's original functions were very practical and protective, there is a clear design element to it, showing a human's basic desire to embellish even the simplest of artifacts. The upper is made up of two or more thicknesses of strong, plain woven hemp, bound together by even rows of hemp string, producing a pattern of dots all over, or it's actually been quilted. So the stitching has become both functional and decorative. And then a drawstring is threaded around the upper edge, which is by a clever method of crossing near the instep, restricts the size of the opening and draws up the slack of the fabric over the toes into this point. It's a bit like a rhinoceros. And this has created this very curious profile. And this thick sole has warp of hemp cord placed lengthways with weft of string plaited in a wrapped twined manner. And furthermore, the entire sole is covered with tight knots of string, which would have had the effect of a hobnailed military sandal of the Romans, or the climbing boots climbing nails in a modern boot. And these knots would have made walking in the sand much easier. This type of sole can also be seen on the footwear of the terracotta soldiers in Xi'an, showing that this sort of footwear is not a single occurrence, but most likely of long functional tradition. It would most likely have been worn as an outer shoe, so an inner shoe of cloth, a simple inner shoe of cloth, and then this shoe on top of it. The shoe was found at a garrison where many Chinese documents are dating from 68 to 56 BCE were found, indicating indeed that this shoe, or artifact, is among the oldest footwear in the V&A collection. Another practical shoe, or shoes, was discovered in one of the westernmost watchtowers with a document dated to CE8, so all very early footwear. And these fairly large shoes got a length of 26 and a half, which is about six, I think. Woven to shape and then closely pressed, which gives a ribbed mat-like structure, texture over the sole and vamp. And the ankles of both shoes have been reinforced with strip of stitched canvas, probably hemp again. And exactly as the previous shoe, these would have been worn on top of inner shoes, and the ankle opening would have been tightened around the legs to ensure that no sand would actually come in, because we do know how annoying that is to get shoes sand in your shoes. The summers in the desert oasis could be very hot, as the winters could be very cold. So ventilated but thick-soled footwear to protect from the heated sand was necessary. And this sandal, this footwear, was so ingeniously made by using only string, again, probably hemp, manipulated in different ways to create a sandal. The sole has been formed from thick string, plaited, and the plait then been coiled flat and bound together by a string passing transversely through the sole. And attached to the sole, as you can see here, is a series of short strings, each of them doubled and twisted to leave two loops at the top. And those strings are then gathered into two groups around the heel and the toes. So the front there is the toe, and that's the heel. And this type of string sandal has been found, again, at the Lima's watchtowers, lowland. And this is from Mazar Tag, and these from Lolan and Darabsandong, showing a long continuity in footwear fashion, I guess. Going on, this fragment of plain woven buff wool is gathered into a band of the same fabrics, which have then been folded over and stitched, which was discovered in Nia. About 100 to 300 CE. And at one end of the piece, you can see here, is there are strips of red wool and a ball of wool, a small ball of cream wool, have been attached. And I'm not really sure if I think Stein actually put them together, because he found them together, that they were not really attached like that when he found them. Based on more complete finds from this area, it is possible that this actually come from the top of a skirt, as you can see here, or a pair of trousers. Stein discovered this torn piece of fabric in the ruins of a large residence with several rooms and a courtyard or a garden, and he thought it had belonged to a quite well-to-do person. However, we were going to talk about silk. So, the silk production of the Han Dynasty is known through an astonishing number of finds, perhaps surprisingly mainly outside mainland China, demonstrating high quality weaving. The elite products of Han silk weaving were the polychrome warp-faced compound plain weaves, as we can see here, the so-called Jin silks. This type comprised of at least two warps in different colours and one weft. And they are probably the most important group of Han silk, with a style so different from any other silk groups. The composition is increasingly varied, it's soft, it's fluid, and consisting of mountain-shaped clouds, striped in brilliant colours. There are birds, dragons, and other strange and weird creatures. And in vigorous movement, they're flying, jumping, and biting each other. They are really a joy of fabric. And then they have the woven characters, which are dedications or auspicious, and consist of about 4 to 6 characters. Most of these polychrome textiles carrying these inscriptions were produced in present-day Sichuan province, which was the main centre of artistic silk textile production of the late Han and post-Han period. They were created and manufactured in the imperial workshops, for predominant use within the Chinese Empire and by court and courtiers. And these silks have been found archaeological in high status burials in central China which of course it is no surprise. And one of the most magnificent finds are from the tombs of Mawanganju in Changsha in Henan province, with numerous luxurious silk textiles, furnishings, and garments. And the tombs belong to Marquis Li Chang, his wife, and possibly their son. However, these Jin silks have also been found to the far west and north in what appears to be tombs of elite members of their society. For example, during excavations at Palmyra in Syria, in present-day Syria, and at the Oglakti burial grounds in southern Siberia, and also in Nonnuala in present-day Mongolian Republic. For example, this rocky landscape, textile in red and orange and yellow, is of superb quality. And the composition is, again, so evocative, with steep cliffs, peach trees and cranes eating gigantic mushrooms. There are no repeats of symmetry or any rim or reason to the design at all, which is brilliant. And many of this type of hand silks have been found along the Silk Route, just showing it again so we all remember where we are, and notably in Nia. I'm just going to try to maybe work this. Sorry. Where is Nia? Nia is kind of there, and then you have Lolan up there. Predominantly in burials. However, this teeny weeny piece, and it's teeny, from the V&I Stein collection, was recovered from a refuse heap in Lolan City, once an important garrison town at the northwestern corner of Lake Lop Nor, showing typical small-scale classic Han patterning cloud scrolls. And we have had recent dye analyses of these, thanks to Professor Richard Larson at the Boston University, revealed that the red dye contained only purpurine and no alizarin, which suggests that something other than the usual madder was used. And the only known species today that contain purpurine, but no alizarin, are of Rilbunium from South America. We don't think, you know, they were importing this dye from South America, but it proves or shows that similar plants might have been growing in this area at one point, or much closer at least than South America. Also discovered in the ruins of Lolan town was this bundle of strips, which you can see here. And believe it or not, it's the shoe. The shoe was made in the twining method, where the silk thread is twined, wrapped around a warp, probably a hemp, and when a hole occurs, when it's damaged, it unravels like a pair of tights. And so this is a similar but complete shoe is in the collection of the British Museum, which was found in the same room of a ruined house as the bundle, which it might indicate that there actually once was a pair. The pattern is clearly visible, of course, on the surviving one, and you can see it's, really colourful. It's cloudy patterns, just like very similar to the Jin silks. And they're divided into three sections with white geometrical curvy pattern on the red ground, on purple, blue, light blue, and yellow. And the bottom, as you can see as well, or the sides of the shoe, have this white curves on a yellow ground. This is really quite a fancy shoe, I would say. And similar shoes are often found in Chinese tombs located in the Gansu province and also in Qingyang. Most of the famous Hanjin silks were discovered in the burial site called LC by Stein, which is located about 7 kilometres to the northeast of Lawland City. The pits contained personal objects such as ornamented bronze mirrors, wooden combs, eating utensils, lacquerware, coins, and the like. Many artifacts typical of the Han dynasty culture of the East Asian heartland. However, wooden trays or miniature tables common in Central Asia, Central China as grave finds seems to have been used by the living in Lawland, judging from the knife cuts and the high wear on these miniature tables, indicating maybe that the people there was not familiar with the original use of the table, or just life in the desert simply necessitated the use, or it could just be a different burial practice had developed. More research is needed there. One of the small pieces in the V&A collection is similar to a recent find in Gutai burial site, also the Lawland area, and also in Nia, showing birds and beasts and with the characters of eternal prosperity. A similar fragment appears to come from another silk bolt with a character of 10,000, yet another piece showing the character of longevity, and a length of Hanjin silk similar to this one is in a private collection. In a private collection, reportedly also from these Lawland Grey Pits LC, has been radiocarbon dated to about 155 BCE to CE 83. And this date is so much earlier than the Chinese establishment within this area, which was around 200 CE. It is possible, therefore, that these precious silks might have been in rotation for a much longer time before being buried, because they might have been so precious, so they were handed down until they lost their status or they lost their use, or they were just really manky and they were just giving them away. Lots of possibility. And from other comparative burial sites, these silks could have been used for furnishings, such as cushions or edgings on blankets or covers. But generally, the silks, this type of silk, seems to have been cut into strips and used to decorate borders, sleeves, and hems of woolen garments. No complete garment has yet been recovered from the Lawland grave pits, but discoveries in other burial sites suggest that a certain type of garment dominated in this region. This style, as you can see here, of kaftan was well cut with sleeves cut separately and then seamed in. They also have very recognizable side gauze. And this type of clothing represents a predominantly a male garment that originated in the Eurasian steppe world and became exceedingly popular in Central Asia. However, sometimes it was clothing on the proper right side, as in Chinese fashion, so it seems like the garments were of nomad origin, but influences from Chinese clothing. We have some remains in the V&A Stein collection where you can clearly, these are fragments of red woolen braid, and it's, it still has some attachment with felted buff wool to it, and were recovered from the site of Endre, which is where the stupa is, we saw just a minute ago. A fort site that had been occupied by the Chinese during the early Tang dynasty. So it is quite, you can kind of see how this would have been kind of the neck. So you can see there. And then the front, as you can see there. So it's likely to have embellished the front opening of a felted garment, or more likely a padded garment, as these ones. These two textile fragments, or these two textile fragments over here is in the V&A collection, and this one is in the National Museum of New Delhi. They are most likely from the same piece ones. And you can see that it's a padded fabric sandwich. It's a wool, like a wool felt has been sandwiched between two finer wool textiles. And then there are decorations here, and you can see them along here. And here's probably the end of the garment. So it would have been quite a wide silk band. They probably would have made up a kaftan-type garment. Most likely similarities in constructions to the kaftan of this mummy, which we found in Nia in 1995, with the wide hems and the wide lapels, or the edgings of the garments. Only a few pieces of garments were made exclusively of figured silk, which has been discovered in this region. This silk kaftan was found at Nia in 1959, and perhaps also these fragments might once have formed parts of complete silk garments. The fragments certainly appear to once have formed gauze. You can kind of see that would be the side panel of the kaftan. And these, you can kind of see there are some look like gauze as well. So different communities, Chinese and nomadic, included what they considered precious materials in important burials. The silks were sartorial trappings of power. And the discoveries of Hanjin silks in the Lopnor region suggest that they were distributed over a much larger area, far from the empire and the original intended area of use only for court and courtiers. These silks were regarded as wonderful as we do now and desired by the people bordering the Han Empire. The polychrome silks were excellent as gifts, payments, or bribery. And judging by these finds, it is also likely that the limited amounts were distributed to foreign rulers and officials. The Chinese annals record as well that much silk and occasional princesses were exchanged with the nomads. And the imperial silks found in these burials in Tarim Basin and beyond are early testimonies to expanding allegiances and kinships. As mentioned in the beginning of this talk, a great deal of silk fabrics, and also mentioned, of course, by Susan, a great deal of silk fabrics, mostly dating to the Tang Dynasty, were discovered by Stein in the library cave in Danwang. And among the circa 40,000 documents, there were paintings on silk, hemp, paper. There was a great number of textiles of various sizes. You have canopies, altar valances, and a handful of complete and fragmented banners, and which give evidence of the importance of this shrine site as one of China's great Buddhist pilgrimage complexes. However, some of the silks might originally have had a more worldly use, as it was common for elite members of the society to donate pieces of, for example, clothing to the monasteries, which really usually were sold on, sometimes for other textiles. But maybe some of them have been cut up or reused to make up sacral objects. So the collection of Danhuang textiles, we might have to look at it from a different angle to see if there's actually other uses behind it. For example, studying this crunched up embroidered blue silk. I'm sorry, we have left them exactly as they've been found, more or less, so that's why it's still crunched up, and then you have to lift it carefully with tweezers and look. And together with a piece in the National Museum of India, which is obviously coming from the same piece of fabric or piece of artifact, which they have actually flattened it out, so it's much easier to look at, revealed traces of seams. And there are quite a lot of seams, and they look like shoulder seams, you know, the sloping ones, where the piece has been joined. So And the embroidery also appears to have had a very rich lining of apricot-coloured silks, which you can see a little bit of here. Possibly could have maybe been a garment of some sort. Another important site for clothing and accessories is Astana, of course. And Astana is just here outside Turfan, south of Turfan. It once served as a burial site for Karakodo, an important trade centre during the Tang Dynasty. Here, Stein unearthed a stunning array of burial objects, including clay figurines, textiles, gold and silver, coins and mortuary cakes preserved in the dry heat of the desert. And the fully clothed bodies buried at the Astana were shrouded in textiles and also accompanied by model garments made of paper and or silk, which were placed alongside them. You need change in the next world, so you know you bring them with you. The most characteristic textile pattern, in the 8th century is the flora medallion, developed from the four-petaled small rosette and woven in warp phase compound twill. As you can see here, these are really quite small, but comparable pattern, if you remember, we did see this one also in the large scroll cover, the patchwork. So it's coming yet again. So it's been distributed. That was in Dunhuang. This is from Astana. And also a pair of shoes, back to shoes again, with rolled up toe caps found in another tomb at Astana burial, is also covered with a very similar textiles. Yeah, shoes with rolled up or extended toes during this period seems to have been the height of fashion. The cat's pyjamas, what you were wearing, judging from surviving footwear, and also seen in figure representations, for example, in earthenware. The shoes could also be identifier of status and power. Toes protruding below the garments would have restricted walking, or it would have really altered your gait, because if you have those really curled toes, you kind of have to make sure you don't fall on your face and losing all credibility. And these two here, as we've seen, these are court dignitaries found a burial earthenware. We do know that they are high up status members. And they are probably, these shoes are probably indicating a privileged life of the wearer and not meant for any manual labour at all. On the contrary, the shoes found by Stein at the ancient city of Gaochang, which is kind of close to Astana, near Turfan, haven't got these protruding shoes, protruding toes at all. And they are slightly made differently. Each shoe is composed by two halves joined at the back of the heel and at the toe, and the halves are made of superimposed layers of wool and hemp textiles stitched together and bound with silk along the edges. So it's a bit like the quilting here again. They are quite decorative. You have the applied band of embroidered and braided silk on the top. They're quite nicely, and there might be some actual metal thread there as well. And also this lovely embroidery on their upper. Stein suggested that from the context where they were found, that they date to the period before the Chinese took the city in 640 CE, and therefore perhaps belonging to the Uyghurs who then occupied the city, or were living in the city. And this, of course, is possible, but the shoes could as well have also belonged to a person of lower status than the pointed-toed dignitaries. A different sort of footwear. It's a bit, if you compare today, what should we say, if you have red-soled Louboutins compared to the new look shoes, which are copies, if you see what I mean. It could be that, but again, need a bit more research. The most remarkable finds dating to the Tang Dynasty are a number of silks with unusually large loom widths, executed in the Westface campaign, Twill, Samite, and showing the powerful, highly coloured animal motifs set in circular frames, which you can see here, which are the most typical creation of the Sasanian textile art. Yeah, you can see a little bit here. And the execution of the patterns and the colour scheme of these seems to suggest a Sogdian type of a manufacture, which is today Samarkand, Uzbekistan. This textile fragment here shows the remains of a boar design. So a boar, you can see his tusk there, which is this one here, and his ear here, which is the ear there, if you can see. And several textiles with a boar's head have been discovered in Astana burial ground. And these particular textiles were intended to use as burial face covers. But others might have been for garments, as you can see in this mural. And there are definitely, could be boars or bunnies. I think they're boars. So the boar fabric, together with these pieces here, wrong way again, sorry. These pieces here. You have the medallion, the pearled roundel. You have ibixes here. But you got the roundels, but with birds. But it is the kind of the same. Showing the type of patterned silk, there is were no boundaries of specific use of certain textiles, meaning there were no distinction between furnishing fabrics or clothing fabrics as we have today. And it didn't matter if the motifs were really big, which you wouldn't have today on your clothing, but that would be, you know, quite impressive if you had a big roundel. So we have to forget about our perception of today, what is suitable for clothing as well, when we're looking at this material. So, to finish it off. The wealth of materials from this area provides a unique opportunity to discover more about its diverse population, different faiths, and, of course, the extensive trade network. It is likely that the textile finds highlight social distinctions in the way of dress and usage of materials. Silk was probably the prerogative for those with means of money and privilege. But it is for sure that Central Asia was a rich cultural melting pot at this period. Thank you.
You can take some questions.
Okay, yeah. Questions for Susan and me.